Hi, and welcome to a new episode of Ethics for a Changing World. People have long worried that the robots are coming for our jobs, but there's now a second set of concerns that analysts are increasingly worried about, and that's the use of algorithms and AI-related systems in management. This week, we're going to be talking about how well-equipped our labour laws are to deal with these new challenges that come with the use of AI in systems that include firing people, docking people's pay, and hiring. And we're going to be asking the question, to what extent can our existing legal frameworks deal with these challenges? And to what extent, conversely, do we just need to completely rethink our approach to them? In particular, we're going to be looking at how the EU is attempting to deal with the challenges of algorithmic management. Firstly, we're going to be looking at its relative success when it comes to the gig economy. And then we're going to be contrasting that with what is a much more mixed record on the challenges of algorithmic management. Without further ado, on with the show. Today, I'm really excited to be joined by Aislinn Kelly-Lythe, who's a researcher on algorithmic management at the Bonavero Institute of Human Rights at the University of Oxford. Hi, Aislinn. Thanks so much for joining us. How about we start by you telling us a little bit about your own work?
Thank you so much, Patrick. So I work as part of a small team at the University of Oxford. We're based at the Bonavero Institute for Human Rights, and we focus specifically on the deployment of technology in the employment context, so what technology means for workers. And our project is generously funded by the European Research Council, so we're actually doing a quite long-term project on this issue and looking at what laws we need to change or adapt to deal with this new phenomenon.
Fantastic. So we're going to be talking a little bit about the application of artificial intelligence to labour. Could you just start by talking us through where we're at with this technology? What technology exists and how is it being used?
Yeah, sure. So I think it's worth starting by saying AI is quite a broad term. So we're seeing various types of technology being used in the employment context. Some of them are very basic. Others are what we might call AI. So usually machine learning would be the most common example of that. But what we're really seeing is the automation of managerial functions. And this is happening from end to end in the employment relationship, so from hiring to firing. And it's also happening across the socioeconomic spectrum. So just to give some concrete examples, we've seen particularly in the media the use of automated technology in the recruitment context. But we've also seen reports of employers using technology to monitor their workers' productivity, to schedule shifts, and to select even for redundancies. And we've seen in particular for office workers, a big increase in the use of monitoring tools since the beginning of the pandemic. So just to give you some figures on this, there's been some research that 16% of US companies put new tracking software into their employees' laptops when they went remote in the first month of the pandemic. And by July that had risen to 26%. And we see also with Google searches, searches for the phrase remote monitoring were up by 212% in April 2020 as compared with the previous year. So we've really seen a massive spike in this phenomenon during the pandemic as well.
Wow, a quarter of employees have their laptops traced. So we're going to be talking about this term algorithmic management, which is what a lot of your work focuses on. Could you just sketch out for us what that means in practice?
Yeah, sure. So I mentioned automated hiring as one area that's got particular media attention. And a particular example of a company doing this is HireVue. So a lot of recent graduates might, for example, be aware of this kind of technology, which essentially is a pre-recorded video interview. And then HireVue enables employers, and this is an optional functionality, to assign scores of about the applicant's performance. So this will look at their language that they're using, their tone, their facial expressions, and will give them scores for topics like friendliness. So that's an example right at the start of the employment relationship. But we've also seen many examples during the employment relationship, for example, companies monitoring employees' communications with each other using sentiment tracking, sometimes looking at whether employees pose a flight risk, which obviously has disadvantages for particular groups. In call centres, we'll see employers using sentiment tracking to assess whether their employees are being friendly on the phone or being helpful on the phone. In particular, we've seen in Amazon fulfillment centres, heavy use of algorithmic management for pickers. So again, in the US, and definitely some of these examples are particularly marked in the US as compared with Europe. But in the US, we've seen hundreds of Amazon workers dismissed because the data shows that they're not being fast enough in their picking at Amazon stores. And often we see the adoption of these tools happening in quite an incremental fashion. So a really good example of this is the Microsoft productivity scores. So Microsoft has been offering a workplace analytics tool for its users since 2017. And this basically is de-identified behavioral metadata. So you can look at workplace trends as a manager and you can see how your teams are operating. And during the pandemic in October 2020, Microsoft updated this tool so that you could actually get individual level evaluation data. And this data used metrics that Microsoft set on things like teamwork. And this occurred at a time, obviously, when many people were working from home and their entire workplace life was taking place via Microsoft's tools. So this did lead to quite a big media backlash. And a couple of months later, in December 2020, Microsoft dropped the individual level analysis and just went back to the overarching behavioral metadata. But the fact that such a big company would adopt this kind of a tool shows how this is really becoming quite a pervasive trend in a very incremental fashion.
And just to pick up on one thing you said there, is there a particular reason why this is especially bad in the US?
I think it really comes down to the regulation that we have in Europe as compared with the US. So if you take the example of the Amazon workers being fired because of their speed, in Europe, we have unfair dismissal laws, which protect people against being fired for not a good reason. So there'd have to be more of an assessment of whether that data provided a good enough reason to dismiss someone, and also whether the employer had gone through the correct procedure in dismissing them. Whereas in the US, they have something called at-will employment, which basically means that an employer can dismiss someone, at least at federal law, without a good reason. So it really comes down to the regulation we have in Europe as compared with the US.
Okay, so that's linked very closely actually to existing employment laws, really. So we're going to go into a bit more detail on these in a minute, but could you just walk us through very briefly a few of the concerns we have relating to the gig economy and algorithmic management?
Yeah, so we've seen an interest from policymakers in this intersection between labour and technology for a while now. You mentioned the gig economy, so we've seen a lot of movement there in terms of strategic litigation and more recently in terms of new laws being proposed or adopted by various governments. But historically, we've also seen a lot of interest in concerns about the automation of tasks. So for example, we've seen predictions of mass unemployment because the robots will come and take all our jobs. And really we haven't seen that materialize, at least yet. But what we have seen is the automation of managerial functions, which I've been mentioning. And you can actually see in recent communications by some governments a shift in interest here. So just to take the EU Commission as an example, in 2018, they put out a communication on AI, which identified this issue of potential unemployment because of jobs being removed by technology as a concern that needed to be tackled. But then by 2020, they published a new white paper on AI. And in that white paper, you can see quite a shift in focus. And there's a realization that actually technology is affecting workers right now because of the algorithmic management situation that I've been talking about, and that this is what needs to be dealt with. So fortunately, policymaking has been increasingly driven by reality. Gig economy issues are still live but are being addressed. And then this algorithmic management issue is one which is really blossoming right now and is being addressed by policymakers.
Okay, and just one last introductory question before we get into the nitty-gritty of this. We're focusing here mainly on the European Union. Your work's obviously supported by a European agency, but are there other particular reasons why we'd want to focus on the EU? Are they, for example, a leader in this kind of regulation?
Well, in general, the EU has proved itself quite effective in adopting progressive measures that have what we call a lighthouse effect. So the GDPR is a really good example of that. The GDPR has a really broad territorial scope. So it means that if a US or a UK company wants to sell products that are going to be used in Europe, they're going to have to start thinking about complying with the GDPR as well. So the EU has a really big influence in that sense on even companies outside of the EU, because everyone wants to do business in Europe. But having said that, the UK is also taking steps in the AI space, and so is the US. So, for example, the White House has proposed a Bill of Rights for the Digital Age, an AI Bill of Rights. And in the UK, we have a national AI strategy, which was published last year. And the Government Office for AI is publishing a white paper later this year on regulating AI. But I think in terms of concrete actions, we've seen the most from the EU in the AI space. And arguably, there's also more political will to adopt worker protective measures from the EU as compared with the UK or the US. So that's the reason why most of our work focuses on the EU for the time being.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So the overarching question that we're going to start with here is, we talked a little bit already about existing employment laws, but how do the challenges associated with algorithmic management and these new technologies, to what extent can they be dealt with by existing employment laws, and to what extent do they differ fundamentally from those and need a completely different approach?
Yeah, I think, as you say, this is the crucial question. Are we looking at a difference in kind or a difference just in scale? And I think it's important to start with the realization that many of the issues we talk about when we talk about algorithmic management can and should be dealt with under existing laws. So we have equality laws that deal with issues of discrimination. We have privacy rights from the European Convention on Human Rights that should deal with many of these monitoring problems. We have data protection rights, and the data protection rights not only limit the collection of data, but also limit its use for different purposes. And of course, we have labour and employment law. So we have employee protections, for example, the protection against unfair dismissal. And we have collective information and consultation rights. So, for example, trade unions having certain rights to information from the employer.
So we definitely already have some legislative framework for dealing with certain issues that arise with algorithmic management. So we're going to be talking a little bit about the gig economy. And the EU issued a platform work directive very recently, literally in December 2021, on the gig economy. And that does a few really interesting things. It mandates human monitoring of systems' impact on working conditions. And it mandates human review, as well as a written statement of reasons for significant decisions. And that includes a decision to suspend a worker's account or refuse payment for work performed. Does this seem to you like a good way of benefiting from the positives of AI while also retaining human oversight?
Yeah, so this directive is really a good example of dealing with some of the issues that I identified earlier. So in particular, the oversight of decisions, the transparency of the decisions. And it's worth noting that this is a draft directive at the moment, so it might still change during the legislative process. But the Commission's draft, which is what we have at the moment, which was published in December, is really promising. So the draft also deals with employment status, which is kind of a separate issue. It's about what rights gig workers get. And in the UK, we've had a recent Supreme Court ruling on that in the Uber case, which determined that gig workers do have certain rights, for example, minimum wage. But the big novel development here is really the types of provisions that you're talking about, the algorithmic management provisions, the transparency provisions. And this is really the first attempt to regulate algorithmic management. And it makes sense that it would be in the gig economy context, because the gig economy has been essentially the cradle of algorithmic management. So there's a really good report by an organization called Worker Info Exchange, which was set up by one of the claimants in the recent Uber case. And it sets out all the ways that this organization has tried to challenge algorithmic management in the gig economy context. And it's really significant in that context, because workers will face issues when they're trying to log into the app. For example, if their facial recognition doesn't work for them, and there's evidence that it works less well for people of color, for example. there'll be situations where people get automated pay, which seems to have deductions, which are unfair. And there are situations where people get barred from the app. So essentially their contract is terminated and they don't have any human recourse. So these are all really clear examples of quite significant algorithmic management and very little ability to talk to a human manager about the decision. So it makes sense that these provisions will be adopted in the gig economy context. But from our perspective, this platform worker directive is a really good model which could be extended into other fields as well, because many of these rights would be really useful for people, for example, working from home and being monitored, or working in an Amazon warehouse as a picker. And those rights should, in our opinion, be extended to those other fields as well. So just to think about some of the rights that it provides, as you said, it requires information to be provided and human monitoring and human review, and these statements of reasons for significant decisions. And these are provisions, particularly the last provision, the statement of reasons, which build on the GDPR. And there are also transparency requirements for public bodies and an improved role for trade unions and worker representatives to do collective consultation and bargaining. So it's really the whole host of points that I've mentioned earlier in this podcast, which could be useful across a range of domains.
So some of our listeners might be aware of the recent court case with Uber, which relates to the classification issue. Could you just briefly explain to us what that's all about?
Of course. So essentially, the gig economy companies like Uber and Deliveroo have long tried to argue that the people who work for those companies, so delivery riders, Uber drivers, are not employees because they have the ability to choose when they work, to choose how long they work. And they've argued that this is essentially a coordinating app between the self-employed worker and the customer, so for example, the Uber rider person who's getting in the car with Uber driver, that has come under quite a lot of criticism, because those apps do exert a lot of control over their workers. So people can't really choose how long they work in terms of needing to know how much they're going to get paid, and there's also a lot of control in terms of how they perform the work. So they can't give out their number to future potential customers, and they can't. They have to abide by certain standards or certain requirements that the company sets. So there's been a long debate over this. In the UK, we've settled this, the Supreme Court settled this debate by putting Uber drivers at least into what we see as a kind of middle category. So we essentially in the UK have self-employed people and we have employees who have the full suite of protections. But in between, we have this category called worker, and they get certain protections. For example, they get minimum wage, but they don't get other protections. So they don't get protection, for example, against unfair dismissal. So we still see people being kicked off the app, for example. So that's what the debate has really been about. It's been about what rights do workers get, and that entails the consideration of what category do they fit into as well.
Okay, and just one last question on the gig economy. It sounded to me like the recent platform work directive is quite promising. Do you think we should be quite hopeful about where this is going?
It does seem like there's a movement beyond the status issue or the classification issue in the gig economy, at least in Europe. We've seen some disappointing developments elsewhere. For example, in California, there was a referendum on this classification issue, which Uber put a lot of money behind, essentially took a step back in terms of the classification of workers, at least from the employee viewpoint. But overall, at least in Europe, in the UK, we're definitely seeing a movement in the right direction. And that's why we're seeing organisations like Worker Info Exchange start to tackle the algorithmic management issue, because they've got beyond the classification issue at least to some extent, and can now look at the conditions of work as opposed to just the terms of the employment contract.
Okay, awesome. So we're going to talk a little bit about algorithmic management now, which the directive, which we said we're quite hopeful about, doesn't apply to. So we're talking about a very different kind of regulation. And one way into this to talk about algorithmic bias. So there are obvious benefits associated with algorithmic management, or potential benefits for workers in terms of automated scheduling of shifts. It's possible that that could allow workers to have more say over how they're scheduled, that they could express more their own needs in terms of that. But those kinds of benefits are only realized for all workers if we can avoid the kinds of algorithmic bias that we talk about in other contexts. Could you just talk us through the bias risk we're worried about in algorithmic management?
Yeah, of course. So this is an issue that really arises primarily with machine learning algorithms, which are essentially models that learn from data. So you'll have, for example, data about previous applicants for a job. You'll feed that into the model, and the model will identify correlations between applicants who have been successful. And then when you expose that model to a new application, a prediction will be made about that applicant's likelihood of success. That's a very simple example. The problem is that sometimes those correlations that the algorithm identifies might not actually be because of the applicant's likelihood of success. So just to take a really simple example, there was a infamous algorithm that Amazon developed for its software engineering roles. And this was developed to identify applicants for the likelihood of success for applicants for software engineering positions. Now, in the past, most software engineers at Amazon had been male, whether that was because of just more male applicants or potentially a combination with some implicit biases of the recruiters. But overall, the algorithm identified that certain traits that were associated with being male were correlated with being a good software engineer. So, for example, the names of two women's colleges were marked down, certain types of language that were more frequently used by men were marked up. And we've seen other examples. So we've seen algorithms that have given higher ratings to applications containing the name Jared or the sport lacrosse. So we see some correlations that don't really have anything to do with the job being used to mark candidates. And that's just a recruitment example, but of course it can apply anywhere else. So as I mentioned with the Uber facial recognition technology, there's been lots of research that's shown that facial recognition technologies work quite badly for black women, for example, just because there aren't many black women in the training data that the algorithm learns to identify faces from. So we do see a lot of these issues of bias, and there's a huge amount of effort being expended to try and fix these issues, but there's only so much we can do really.
Okay, and is there, just very generally speaking, is there something which makes algorithmic management particularly difficult to regulate as opposed to, say, the gig economy?
Well, one particularly difficult thing about algorithmic management or the regulation of algorithms is the opacity. And if you think about it in the discrimination context, how do you know if an algorithm has discriminated against you? So, for example, we've seen lots of research on job adverts, for example, on Facebook, being shown to different groups. So women being shown less well-paid jobs and job adverts, or delivery driver adverts being shown mainly to men and secretary adverts being shown mainly to women. Now, if you're a man who sees a delivery driver advert, you won't know that you haven't been shown the secretary advert, for example. So there's a lot of opacity here in actually trying to challenge the outputs of the algorithm because you might not know about them, and then also challenging the inner workings of the algorithm because you usually won't know how it works. But the thing we have to remember is that this isn't necessarily a negative. There's also an opportunity here because, particularly as it comes insofar as bias is concerned, there's more quantifiability. So we can see that opacity isn't a foregone conclusion. It's something that we can regulate to ensure. And really the point here is enforceability. So if we think there are two avenues for enforcing a law, there's either an individual bringing a case in court, or there's a public body taking action. I think those are the two most common routes in the UK, at least. Now, in terms of individual litigation, as I mentioned, most people won't know when they've been disadvantaged by an algorithm. And they'll also have difficulty in getting the evidence, even if they have a feeling they have. And then in terms of public bodies, we've just seen a massive under-resourcing compared to the needs. So if we take the Equality and Human Rights Commission, their funding has been cut, I think, by around 80% since 2010. And the ICO, that's a bit better resourced, but has to really focus on these massive data breach issues we have. So, for example, they're trying to regulate Google and Facebook. They probably don't have time to get to small employers using monitoring technologies. So it's really about enforceability and transparency. It's not a fundamentally inherent problem. It's really something that we can regulate if we target our resources in the right way.
So we're going to talk now a little bit about the EU's AI Act specifically, which is another recent proposed piece of legislation. They're clearly busy in the EU at the moment. And one point that's raised in the act is a prohibition on systems that deploy subliminal techniques beyond a person's consciousness to materially distort their behavior. To me, that seems a bit far-fetched, and you yourself have noted in writing that it's already banned under EU law. But is this something we should worry about in the future more broadly?
Yeah, so if we think about these kind of subliminal techniques to manipulate our behavior, it seems like they're also thinking about potential manipulation of consumer behavior, possibly also voter manipulation. So trying to manipulate people in terms of what they vote for, because we've seen a lot of that in the media. Should we be concerned about this in the employment sphere? I mean, there's always a risk about this, but the problem is that the Act requires intentionality. So it would require an employer to intentionally deploy this kind of subliminal technique. And when a commission representative was asked about, you know, how this would play out in practice, the example does seem really far-fetched. So it was an inaudible sound played in a truck driver's cabin to push them to work longer hours than were safe. And as you mentioned, I've noted that this would probably be unlawful under the EU working time laws that we already have. And although, having said that, we have seen some examples of nudging in the gig economy. So for example, an Uber driver going to log out of the app and they'll get a notification pop up saying you'll make X more dollars if you work this much longer in all probability. And then they might end up working longer than they would have intended. But it's difficult to see whether that would necessarily be captured under this provision. So in general, this list of prohibited AI practices, which this is one of a list of prohibited practices in the Act, most of them are not really relevant to the employment context. And in general, these prohibited practices are quite narrow. So really, when we look at the EU AI Act, the prohibited practices are less relevant than what we call a second category, which is the high risk types of practices. And those are really where most of the impact will be if this instrument is adopted.
Thank you. That's a perfect segue into this next question. So when we're talking about high-risk AI, which includes AI which can be used for employment, workers' management, and access to self-employment, the Act states that the AI system needs to manage and mitigate risks. So the data sets need to be appropriate and examined for potential biases, and instructions of use need to be given to the user. Put simply, the obligations here are on the AI provider, the people making the AI, and not the user, the employer. Do you think this is a good strategy?
Yeah, so as I've alluded to, there is quite a lot of regulation of what employers do because we have a lot of labour and employment law. What we don't have so much is regulation of the vendors. And this is quite a problem because often the employers will lack the technical knowledge. So as I said, it would be good to have more transparency and consultation rights in the employment context. But the employer will already bear almost all of the GDPR obligations, all of the employment and labour obligations. So it makes sense for us to also regulate the market side. So regulate what's actually coming to market as well, and make sure that they're subject to some kind of standards too.
Awesome. And the app also requires algorithmic vendors to self-certify in terms of their compliance, which sounds a bit like marking your own homework, really. Do you think this is dangerous, especially in this kind of context? Like, do you think that we have a sufficiently clearly defined idea of what, for example, would constitute a potentially biased data set for this kind of self-certification to work?
Yeah, so this idea of self-certification actually comes from product safety law, and this whole act is really a product safety regulation style. So if you think about something like a computer or a part of a vehicle, these kinds of objects will need to be produced in compliance with certain technical requirements. So for example, to make sure that your coffee machine doesn't blow up when you're trying to make your coffee in the morning. So it makes sense that, you know, you can check those very technical requirements, potentially self-certify, and if it comes down the line and there's some problem, there could be evidence to check whether you actually certified in a correct way. The problem when we get to the AI regulation is that the standards, as you say, are much more nebulous. So, for example, there's a requirement that the training data for the machine learning models I mentioned is relevant, representative, and free of errors. Now, what does that mean? it's likely that self-certifying compliance with those kind of standards could end up being a rubber stamp if there isn't very clear external checks on the compliance with those requirements.
Sounds a bit like they're marking their own homework on this one, doesn't it?
Exactly.
And the AI Act also calls for a publicly accessible database containing information about high-risk AI systems. Do you think this is a useful approach? Presumably, like anyone could just access this database on what are deemed risky AI systems.
It is definitely a positive step because at the moment there's very little knowledge about what's out there. We've really had to rely on some excellent investigative journalist work and on academic studies to know what kind of tools are being used. But in terms of what's actually going to be on this database, it's quite limited. So, for example, a lot of the really juicy information will be in what we call the technical documentation in the Act. So this would have things like what trade-offs have been made, what the accuracy levels are like for different groups. So, for example, if you were someone who thought you might have faced discrimination, that technical documentation would be really helpful in supporting your claim. But that's not going to be on the database, even in redacted form. So there are limitations to what this database is going to be useful for. But nonetheless, the database is still really important because of a big gap in the Act, which is that there's almost a complete absence of individuals who are actually affected by AI. So in the GDPR, we have loads of rights for data subjects. So that's the people who are actually being monitored, for example. But in the AI Act, there are basically no rights for people who have been impacted by an AI decision. So at least this is some way for everyone, including people who are impacted by AI, to have a sense of what's actually out there, what's actually on the market.
Awesome. So I just want to ask one more question before we wrap up, if I may. We talked briefly about this system, which we think is probably a little bit far-fetched, the subliminal systems which impact your behavior, which probably aren't being used very much at the moment. But we often have this problem with regulation of technology, which is that it takes a couple of years, say, to actually get the regulation ready, and regulators are therefore always way behind the curve on social harm. Do you think this kind of, proactive mitigation strategy is a good way of trying to deal with things by trying to predict what's going to come and then respond before it actually happens?
Yeah, it does make sense to take a kind of proactive future-proofing approach. And we do see elsewhere in the Act that this kind of approach has been taken or attempted to be taken. So the way that the high-risk categories are defined, for example, as we mentioned, one of them is employment. But there are actually a number of categories in which high-risk AI can potentially occur. So they're all areas where we might have seen in the past either safety issues or maybe civil liberties issues. And then the way that the Act is framed is that the Commission can actually adopt new use cases within those categories. So for example, right now in employment, we have two types of AI used in the employment space, but the Commission, if new types of harmful AI in the employment context arise, the Commission, instead of having to go through an entire new legislative process, would be able to add on use cases within that section. So we do see future proofing, and I think our experience with the GDPR has shown us how important that is, because as you say, technology is always developing and legislators can't always keep up otherwise.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, Ashlyn. It's been a really interesting conversation.
Thank you. It's been great being here.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you'd like to hear more about what we get up to, that includes tech explainers and roundups of tech regulation and new technologies, then you can follow us on Twitter at EthicsTechPod or on Instagram at Ethics for a Changing World. And we'd be really grateful if you could share the show with anyone you think might enjoy it. See you next time.